Hello there, and welcome back to Scene by Scene with Josh and Dean, the podcast where we break down the movie American Splendor scene by scene, talk about Harvey Pekar, and discuss the joys and challenges of being professional cartoonists. I'm Josh Neufeld of joshneufeld.com.
And I'm Dean Haspiel of deanhaspiel.com.
And we have a guest on the podcast today.
What's up? I'm Ed Piskor from the Cartoonist Kayfabe YouTube channel. You could just Google me.
Welcome, Ed. So cool of you to join us on the pod.
Looking forward to it, fellas.
Awesome. So today we are discussing scene number 23 of American Splendor, which starts at 1 hour, 2 minutes, and 32 seconds, and ends 8 minutes and 14 seconds later at 1 hour, 10 minutes, and 46 seconds. And that corresponds to chapter 15 of the DVD, which is titled Late Night with Harvey Pekar. And true to the title, we open the scene in New York City at the Warwick Hotel, where, true to form, Harvey is making himself at home in the most messy way, and their room, he and Joyce's room, is a total disaster, though it does have a nice bottle of orange soda chilling in the ice bucket. And Harvey is figuring out what he wants to wear on the Letterman show, while Joyce is not cool with the outfit he chooses, but she takes the American Splendor t-shirt that he was planning on wearing and she starts doing something to it with scissors, merchandising, she calls it. Then we cut to an ingenious montage of vintage videos of Harvey Pekar's real initial appearances on the David Letterman show, and those are cut with scenes of Harvey and Joyce, as played by Paul Giamatti and Hope Davis, backstage in the green room preparing to go on and dealing with the PAs and various folks who are there to take care of them, and it really is pretty cool to see that being cut back and forth, and also just to see the actual Harvey Pekar from the 1980s. This is the young, vibrant, mid-40s Harvey. You might even call him ruggedly handsome or a modern-day Brando. So Harvey and David Letterman banter in a very passive-aggressive or maybe just aggressive way. And Joyce, who's watching backstage, quickly discovers that she's not amused and calls the whole thing pandering, and she actually switches off the channel and tries to find news of what's going on in the world, particularly the Iran-Contra affair, which is just about to burst onto the scene. She later diagnoses Letterman from her handy DSM-3 as a megalomaniac. So she continues her tradition of diagnosing just about everybody who shows up in the movie. But despite the friction and sparks that fly between David Letterman and Harvey Pekar, his visit is a success, and he ends up being invited back a number of times. And they show a montage of some of the various later appearances by Harvey and trips back and forth to New York, etc. But Harvey realizes that really he's being brought back mostly for laughs and not really to treat his comics or his comics writing or the subject of his comics with any seriousness. Along those same lines, Toby Radloff, his co-worker at the VA hospital, is discovered, quote-unquote, as well, thanks to an MTV piece on Harvey, who they call a comics artist. Don't know how I feel about that. Anyways, while MTV is covering Harvey, they also meet Toby and fall in love with our genuine nerd, who then makes a number of feature appearances in MTV shorts as well. And then we see one behind-the-scenes shot of Paul Giamatti Harvey tromping around the set and making a nuisance of himself while the Toby pieces are being put together, and has a hilarious encounter with this ridiculous new wave director who tries to throw him off the set. And at the end, the real Harvey has a voiceover where he talks about how real salt of the earth people like he and Toby are being portrayed as losers in the system by the corporate conglomerates that control pop culture. And he ends it by saying, hey, what can you say? It was the 80s, man. So, discuss.
Yeah, it's a long scene. And if I may jump in just quickly before Ed shares some thoughts. Just to, yes, it does start, actually it starts the scene with the New York City landscape featuring the Empire State Building. Then it goes into the Warwick, and the music that's playing over that, the transitional music, is Oh Lady Be Good by Dizzy Gillespie.
And I thought there was a really funny moment where, so you see the Warwick Hotel, it's pretty fancy looking, right? It's a midtown Manhattan type thing. And then we cut to the hallway, interior hallway, and we see Paul Giamatti portraying Harvey walking in his underwear with like a bucket of ice, you know, kind of thing. And then you see this woman walking toward him and they're doing like this hopscotch because she's kind of afraid of what she's encountered here in this fancy hotel. And he doesn't care. You know, he's being Harvey Picard. This is who he is, you know. And I actually really appreciate that. And I love that moment. But it's played a little bit for comedy.
Yeah, authenticity. Always works with Dino.
And then we cut to, we see the orange soda in that bucket. And all I could think about at that moment is, isn't that where champagne is supposed to be? Like, don't you think they'd be like, or some kind of, you know, Cavassier or something like that, you know?
Your finest bottle of orange soda.
Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, we see Joyce. And whenever I see a woman holding scissors, I get afraid. Like, I don't know how you guys feel, but the first word that pops into my head is emasculation, you know? And in this scene,
interesting.
She is literally cutting up his clothes, and you don't really know why.
Right, we don't know why.
She hints at it. She says, mm-hmm. He looks at her, what are you doing? She's like, merchandising. And she's already, you know, the wheels
one
are turning in her head.
One eyebrow is raised, yeah.
Right. And in fact, actually, I want to make a quick reference to the comic book story, which we'll go back and forth on, but in the movie, it seemed to be that a producer reached out on their own to Harvey and left a message on the answer machine.
Kind of out of the blue.
But in the comic book, it appears that Joyce was actively pursuing, knowing they were going to be visiting New York. And she, on a whim, thought, oh, Harvey should be on David Letterman's show kind of thing. You know, so she helped set it up along with another friend, a mutual friend, to make this happen. So that was like, you know, not in the movie, but that's in the comic book reference.
Right. And the comic we're talking about, of course, is titled Late Night with David Letterman. And it was in American Splendor number 12, 1987, and illustrated by Jerry Chambray.
That's right. So we cut from him getting dressed, abandoning the white t-shirt that she can cut up and turn into merchandising, with we cut to something that I had forgotten about watching those old late night Letterman shows, was the late night thrill cam. And it just really was just a camera attached to the ceiling that would just zoom over the audience and over to David Letterman. And it's kind of like this jarring moment because it's setting up, you're going to go on Letterman, and then you wonder, is an actor going to play him? Are they going to like just kind of stage this? Like, but no, they of course cut to real footage because they have archival footage of this event, of these events that happen on television,
which they were given permission to use by the David Letterman production company.
That's right. And then so we cut to an interior green room where we see Harvey and Joyce sitting. He's nervous. He's losing his voice again. He's hungry. And then the assistant pulls him away. And as he pulls him away, we then cut to the real Letterman introducing the real Harvey in the archival footage. And it, again, it's like this beautiful kind of like merging of fiction and fantasy, you know, semi-autobio, like at its roots, you know. But the weird thing, and I just read this in the comic for this podcast, just reminding myself, Harvey comes out swinging and they start sparring.
Yeah.
And it's very uncomfortable, you know. And I can't tell because there's this like shit-eating grin that Harvey has on his face, like a Cheshire cat, you know, like he knows he's messing with David. And when you read the comic, he planned it, you know, right before. And like, and I felt bad for David, actually, because David did a really good job handling kind of like, you know, this kind of tense situation, and it becomes like a friendly bicker. But I was kind of shocked when I, you know, in hindsight, to see that Harvey was literally bullying David in a lot of ways, you know. But
poor
again,
David, I like how you're on a first name basis.
My friend David Letterman. But as you said, we cut back to Joyce in the green room. She is getting bored with the parlay. She wants to watch the news, which I have to admit, I just don't feel like that was true. That kind of took me out of the movie for a second there, because it feels pretentious. I get it as a character thing that, you know, the character might want to do that, but I couldn't believe in my heart that Joyce couldn't watch 5 minutes of her husband on national TV live.
Well, especially because that call was the thing that got her out of bed, that like,
that's right,
that triumphed over her depression.
And according to the comic, it was her idea. So you think she's want to watch and, you know, how it pans out, you know, but she is getting disgruntled during it. Like, ugh, this is annoying. She's annoyed by it. And maybe that was her own kind of coping mechanism, was to avoid it.
I feel like she is actually playing the Harvey Pekar role at that moment. Like, because he's out there, you know, doing the shtick, she has to represent his authenticity and his rejection of pop culture celebrity bull.
Right. And then, as you mentioned, Josh, Toby Radloff kind of gains fame as a genuine nerd on MTV, which is kind of like, for him, that's the apex, because he's such a fan of Revenge of the Nerds previously. Now he is King Nerd,
right?
You know, and representing all nerds. And then, yeah, as you said, Harvey has this epiphany that he's being co-opted by corporations, and, you know, they're just basically putting him on the show for laughs, you know? So those are kind of my notes. Although there's a moment where during where we're watching Toby, you know, being directed, you know, or whatever it is for the nerd stuff, there was a new wave 80s song. What was the song that was playing over that? Which, again,
Silent Morning by Noel.
Silent Morning by Noel. And I love that song. And I remember hearing that when, you know, and I probably own that song somewhere. But it was just in contrast to a Harvey Pekar, you know, all the jazz he listens to and the blues and whatnot. It was a little jarring to hear that, and also funny. So, Ed, did you have any thoughts about the scene or any notes?
Many thoughts. One question I have for both of you guys.
Yes.
I am curious if either of you have, in real time, when the show first broadcast, like, did you ever catch Harvey on the Letterman show?
So I remember my father had gotten this giant, it was almost the size of a refrigerator, and it taped television shows, you know, and I can't even say.
It's probably Betamax.
It was like Betamax.
Yeah.
And it just was huge, and I had to learn how to use it, and it just felt like it almost like a DJ set or something. Like, it was so complicated, and like these big buttons. And I remember hearing or watching that they were going to have a comic book writer on the Letterman show, and I was like, I've never seen a comic book writer. Like, I love comic books, but I want to know what one looks like. How do they sound?
You'd never
been
to a convention or anything like that at that point.
And you know, I mean, I was still just buying comic books off the newsstand and comic shops, you know, probably. Right. So
this would have been 1986, so you would have been like 19.
Oh, wait a second. So then I did know what a comic book writer, because I'd already been assistant to Chaykin and Simonson and Sienkiewicz. Right. But I just remember thinking, like, who's a person that only writes comic books?
Right,
because
again,
I was around artists that also wrote, you know, and I hadn't met like Chris Claremont or anybody like that yet, you know, that were writing like some of my favorite comic books at the time.
Right.
And it was an alternative indie comic book writer. So I was like, well, what type of guy? And I had read some American Splendor comics. So anyway, he comes on and I was flabbergasted at like, how he's behaving, you know, so cranky and blue collar and kind of had a swagger. And I was a little like nervous, but also confused, I think, watching, as probably was David Letterman, you know,
your buddy David,
my buddy David. And so, but I remember taping it, watching it, and then like it happened. And then I must have watched that video 100 times.
Really?
Just like, what is going on with this guy?
Wow.
And also, don't forget, guys, like the Harvey Pekar we saw were the many iterations of his drawings from R. Crumb to Jerry Shammer and everybody else, you know? So like, I was like, to see the real guy, you know, was fascinating to me, you know?
Did you have any thought at that point that you might want to illustrate something for him?
I think I always admired his comics as an autobio, you know, kind of comics guy. But I think really what kicked me in the pants was the fact that you had gotten a job, Josh.
Right, right.
And then I wanted to prove that I too could draw.
But that was quite a bit later.
But I actively videotaped and recorded this and studied these appearances, to be honest, and it was fascinating. But Josh, what about you?
Yeah, I did not know anything about this. I was totally oblivious to American Splendor and only really discovered him and started reading his Harvey stuff like maybe almost 10 years later, you know, like right around when I started trying to draw for him. And I did not know about any of this Letterman stuff. In fact, I probably heard about it for the first time when I read it in American Splendor number 12. And, you know, was reading up on all those back issues. And it's weird too, because I was a big David Letterman fan and I loved his show, and it really defined, you know, my teenagehood in late night, you know, TV watching, and my stance on popular culture and things like that. But somehow I missed the Picard Letterman intersection.
What about you, Ed?
Oh, that was well before my time.
Yeah, you're a youngin'.
You're born in 82, if that's correct, right? Yeah.
So there was this big gap. I saw Comic Book Confidential, the documentary. That's where I first laid eyes on Harvey.
Right.
When I first saw his comics. And then there was a major gap in my connection to Harv for years, basically until Wizard Magazine. There was a feature called Palmer's Picks, and they covered some American Splendor comics. And at that point, they were already being published by Dark Horse. And one of the covers that they showed off was Gary Dumm, Joe Zabel painted cover that had David Letterman on it. So that's how I discovered that he was even really on the show.
I remember that cover.
This scene, I'm super thankful that you guys like include me in this scene for us to talk about, because one of the things that I really like that I think that the American Splendor directors and producers really nailed is the fact that they were able to kind of keep the anthology vibe with all of the different iterations of Harvey in the film. So we have the Paul Giamatti, the pig vomit version of Harv, and then it segues into, you know, real life Harvey. And then there will be other parts, maybe you guys already covered them, where there's the stage play, there's cartoon Harvey, there's all these different Harveys in this thing. And I think that was such a smart creative decision necessary for the flick, but I think it could have easily have been overlooked by a less ambitious set of creators. So
absolutely. Yeah. And even with this scene, this particular scene, the way he's jumping back and forth between Giamatti and the real Harvey, and it's not the real Harvey during the shoot Harvey, the older Harvey, but that younger Harvey,
right,
was really fascinating because it becomes even more real somehow.
But it's also cool because I was listening to the director's commentary, and they said that Paul Giamatti actually wore Harvey's actual clothes that he had worn during that interview, which is amazing that he still had them, you know, and that Giamatti fit into them. But it was so interesting because for the first time, you kind of see how little they actually do look like each other. Because I think Giamatti pulls off more the older Harvey a little bit better. But going back and seeing what Harvey actually looked like back in 1986, they're like, no, they don't look at all alike.
Right.
But yet seeing them in the same clothes and then right next to each other, it's sort of like you just suspend disbelief. And you're like, yeah, I totally am vibing on this. This is so cool. Just experiencing this.
I think
this.
It totally works. And when you see younger Harvey on the Letterman program here, you really, you can't help but think about the Jerry Shamry American Splendor illustrations. And then I start to wonder, oh, damn, how many freaking photos did he take of this guy?
I know.
Because, you know, it's all photorealistic. And it's like he captured them at every single angle. And there doesn't seem to be much imagination in those strips. Like the guy is always looking at a photo. So my mind goes to that place because he is so spot on with his interpretation of Harv, Jerry Shamry I'm talking about here.
Yep.
Yeah. He definitely is one of the definitive Picard artists along with Crumb.
Yeah, I also like Drew Friedman if we were throwing names out there.
Yeah, he's a good one too, but he didn't do that much.
No, maybe 4 or 5 pages. But he did the cover to the Doubleday book.
Right.
Which if we wanted to talk about that, like when I was a kid and going to the mall, there wasn't even Watchmen in the Walden books. It was like ElfQuest, The Crow, and the Doubleday, American Splendor, and they would be nestled right on the same bookshelf as like Dungeons and Dragons modules and shit.
That is so random.
I'd add one other book that I would see all the time that was also like a Bible to me, and that's the famous Stan Lee Marvel Comics.
Oh, like How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way?
Too.
Or the Marvel Comics Origins?
The Origins, yeah.
Yes, the Origins of Marvel Comics.
Like, between that and, like,
in
the Picard Doubleday
reprint,
book.
Probably.
But let me ask you guys this. Do you think the Doubleday book with the Drew Friedman orange cover, do you think that must have been a consequence of his appearances on Letterman, right?
No, because, okay, so if you see the video, if you're reminded, he's on the show because of the Doubleday Collection.
Okay.
And in fact, all I could think about when I heard that was, and David Letterman even says, it collects the first 9 issues of American Splendor. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, God, like, imagine just, I mean, yes, it took 9 years, I believe, because he did, it was an annual affair. But, like, imagine, like, your first 9 issues of any comic puts you, gets you on a TV show, you know, like that. Man, I wish I had that kind of sway, you know?
But we did find out, by reading the comic, we discovered that it's likely the connection was, what was his name, Steve O'Donnell?
There's a guy named Steve O'Donnell.
Steve O'Donnell.
When you looked him up.
Yeah, so he was a writer for David Letterman, and he was from Cleveland.
So that must have helped.
He must have been a fan and, you know, kept talking up Picard until they finally were like, all right, bring the guy on, kind of thing.
But even so, I think, like, I did believe that David Letterman was a fan of the work as well, of the comics.
Oh,
you
really?
Know?
I bet he never read any of them.
Oh, I think he was. And then you heard what he said years later when he was quitting the show and Harvey had already passed away. One of the few people that he mentioned that he, you know, regretted never having back on the show and wanted to bury the hatchet, basically, was
Harvey
Picker.
No, but they did. They did bury the hatchet.
Oh, they did?
Yeah. Like,
but
after our cancer year came
post
out. I think he did. I think he did give a quote.
Yeah.
Like something about he was a real, you know,
so
he
they
was
got,
a real
So
human
after,
being.
I mean, I know we're jumping ahead a little bit probably, but like after they he stopped going on the show, what do you mean? Did he go back on the show
we
one more time?
We should save it because okay. we should talk about that after the episode where things go okay. crazily off okay. the rails. But,
so, but anyway, yeah. right now in the movie and in Harvey's chronology of the story, you know, he gets on the show and, you know, he becomes semi-popular. It seems, and is asked on several times, but he starts to grow weary because he feels like he's a joke. Oh, and the thing we didn't mention, or you didn't mention, was, well, you find out what the merchandising that Joyce did
right.
was create this absurd-looking
scary
Harvey doll.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, how did she get his face on the doll?
That was a Drew Friedman drawing, right?
No, I think that was Robert Crumb.
Oh, was that Crumb? Oh, yeah, I think you're right.
But was it printed on a sock or something? I don't understand how.
That's
a
big mystery, man. Like, it must be like imagining Joyce with like burning silk screens and stuff.
Oh my God.
With a printer's apron on and
ink
all over her face. Yeah.
And then burning sage after that to ward off the evil of this doll, this little Chucky version of
Harvey Picard. It was a horrifying doll.
And then there's this funny bit during the Letterman interview where that he asks about the doll. He's like, let's talk about the little doll to kind of make fun of Harvey. And
yes.
he's like, yeah, let's talk about it. And then he finds out it's $34.
Which was how much is that in like 2019 dollars?
It must have been $100-something.
Yeah.
Insane.
Hey, it's a piece of art.
It is a piece of art. Exactly, Ed. Good on you. So, but, and then he just goes off on this, and then Harvey turns that around to a funny
yes.
joke.
Yes, yes.
So,
I'm not asking for it. My wife is.
That was so good. But yeah, that doll, and I always wondered about that. And it was just funny that she was like, it was almost like this voodoo thing happening.
Yes, yes, very much.
Oh my God, that's terrifying.
In some ways, I feel like that speaks to the realities of independent comics, certainly at that time, because you kind of needed to do whatever you could to make a couple of dollars in that game. And that doll actually, because it's so boutique and one of a kind, and you know, she has to sew these things. It made me think of, if you look in those early issues of Dan Clow's 8-Ball, where he's like painting those girly ties for $100 a pop, you know?
And, oh, and my like, gosh.
You know, cartoonists were doing just whatever they could to like
yeah.
keep practicing the craft and not having to get like a proper job. Even though, of course, we all know he had the clerk gig and all that.
Yeah, the clerk job. But you're reminding me now of something that's become kind of a, let's call it a tradition now, the Small Press Expo and SPX and you know, Mocha and other, is like, it seems like more people will buy the merchandise than they will the comic.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never been a person that like created merchandise. I might have made a print or something.
Yeah.
I've never done the buttons. I've never silk screened or like made, you know, dolls or whatever. And it seems like that seems to sell more. What's your experience with that, Ed?
I'm not a merchandise guy personally, but they're like, say in the earlier, you know, 20 teens or however you call it, I became more and more acquainted with essentially the outliers of web comics. And mm-hmm. because these people had no books, but huge freaking audiences,
yeah,
they needed to figure something out. And
yeah, they need to sell something, some object. Yeah.
It would not be my style, like Like, I'm just not that kind of dude, man. I would feel weird selling pens with my drawings on it or something. Mm-hmm. But you would see things running the gamut from mouse pads to tumblers for alcohol. I don't even know what you use a tumbler mm-hmm. for. I'm such a square. I was going to say whiskey, but I thought maybe that might be wrong. Dry erase board.
I just drink out of the bottle.
Yeah, I was going to say Dean just drinks out of the bottle. Right out of the bottle.
But you would see all these, tchotchkes. And one of the people who has kept me company more than anybody else while I draw comics is the Howard Stern Show. And the way he would like lambast people who like sell tchotchkes, he would always go hard on like Bill O'Reilly, who would try to corral people into buying, the Bill O'Reilly tour jacket and junk like that. And I'm just like, I'm not going to be a hoe like that, but to each their own, whatever makes you sleep yep. well at night. But just going back to this sequence, man, I have a fun story about Harv. That kind of goes along with his thing about in the green room about they should have some donuts here. Mm. One of the very first public things I ever did, like in front of a crowd, was with Harv at a really small school here in Western Pennsylvania called Slippery Rock University. And he was driven to the school by Hollywood Bob, his limo driver. Mm-hmm. Things were running a little bit late, but they have a green room set up and they have all these like turkey wraps and donuts and all this kind of junk for us. And Harv's sitting there, he's having a good time, he's eating. But when it's time to go out there on stage, he even brings a couple of wraps. And while we're up there on the dais in front of hundreds of people, like he's chewing through his answers and stuff like that. Yep. And I thought that was so cool, man, because I was hungry too. And I just like right before it was time to go on, like I went to the side of the stage, kind of my back to the crowd, and just like woofed down my sandwich. But he didn't give a crap, man. And he sat there for the whole hour
on stage.
And would just, nibble on his stuff in between questions, man.
That's right. That's right.
That's awesome.
You're reminding me of a story that, did I tell this story about what Ed did to me?
I don't think we should even go there because that's like Me Too shit. And there's a lot of pearl clutching bitches out there, man.
Okay. You're right. That teaser right there is enough for people to ask you at a con in private.
It increases our legend, Dino.
That's right. But I did love that prank you pulled, even though I was a little shocked at the moment. It was a lot of fun. And I felt like it bonded us in some way,
Well, here we are now, man.
Exactly. And actually, so I was going to ask you, how did you discover American Splendor, the comic book? But you kind of answered that. It was through Palmer's Picks and Wizard World?
No, it was Comic Book Confidential, the documentary.
Okay.
It aired on regular television, just on cable TV. It was the A&E channel. I will never forget this because it was one of those life-changing moments. Because I'm flipping through the channels. You see Spider-Man first, and then it goes into a Stan Lee spiel. And directly after Stan Lee, it goes right into the Undergrounds and Robert Crumb.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so great. But wait, I have to go back because I'm just confused and I feel like some part of my brain has been activated, but it's like my wires are crossed. Because you mentioned Hollywood Bob, the limo driver.
Yeah. Yeah, I drew a Hollywood Bob story for Harv in American Splendor, I believe.
So, yeah, can you guys remind me?
Oh, fuck, man.
What the deal is? Why do I not know this?
I have a good Hollywood Bob story.
All right, you should tell your Hollywood Bob, but all I know is when I was asked to draw, and I do believe I drew like a one-page Hollywood Bob story.
Yeah, that does sound familiar.
I, too, was confused as I was drawing.
So neither of you have ever met Hollywood Bob?
Never.
I met the guy. The movie The Room, that Tommy Wiseau character, not mm-hmm. far off.
Yeah.
Very old dude, but with that black shellac in the hair, kind of right. an 80s bouffant mullet kind of thing. One long right. pinky nail with a fingernail polish on it. He carried guns. This kind of freaked me out because I don't know what reference you used, Dino, but if you met him, he would proffer you his business card, which would have, the Hollywood Bob limo agency, blah, blah, blah. On the back of it, it was a photograph of he and Meg Ryan, I believe, standing outside of one of his limos.
That's amazing.
Holding guns?
he had...
Like in a Mexican standoff?
He had definite plastic surgery on the jib, like definitely pulled back a little bit. But he was an author. and he had his books on him. And these books, now the guy who was the moderator for our panel at that college was a dear friend named Tony Norman. He's the editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette newspaper and has been for a very, very long time. Big comics fan. Mm-hmm. And so he has that, you know, 10,000 hours Malcolm Gladwell experience of being able to interview you and give you enough rope to hang yourself with and pretend like he's interested and like really cares, but just like is right. giving you that right. comfort, that comfort level to just keep going. So Hollywood Bob right. was like telling us, and I saw some of the books, dude, run on sentences, crazy shit. Like I'm going to be honest with you guys here. I was very scared for Harvey. I had no idea like what he saw in this dude, like who he was in league with. And there will be an end piece to this story. So remind me to tell it because it has to do with a Google search very recently that anybody could do.
Wow. Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because you're saying, what did I, portray him from visually? And I don't remember. And I don't know if they didn't have a picture and just described him to me. And the way you described him now is kind of how I remember drawing him.
I know your piece. And it was okay. pretty good.
So maybe it was based on like one photo or because I don't remember, you know, so maybe it was pretty close, but I love your description of this guy.
I tell you about the books? The books that he authored are the most important things because not only did he have presumably Meg Ryan to shepherd around in the limousines, man, but he also had CIA agents and people who work in secret for the government, scientists and whatnot. And they entrusted Hollywood Bob with the intelligence information of like what's going on in Area 51, what happened during the Kennedy assassination, and some other various bits about alien invasions and whatnot. That's what these books are about.
He talks about this in the books. He spills the beans.
Yeah. And he's the guy who has been entrusted with the information because he's been shepherding around these people in his limo.
Oh, my God.
But Harv, I think, found some like weird fascination in the guy.
Absolutely.
But he saw him as harmless, and I didn't. And that's the thing that like was made me nervous for Harvey, you know, because like a lot of people came out the woodwork, I'm sure, you know. This one made me super nervous for him. As far as I know, no ill came to Harv from this dude at all.
To partially answer, and I'm positing this, of course, we can't ask Harvey right now, but like me and Josh have discovered through doing this podcast that he seemed to be a collector of misfits and outliers and weirdos and
yes,
and so you know, and I guess we're part of that gang too a little bit, but. Yeah, I think that he probably could see through and see something else that, I mean, how old were you when you met Hollywood Bob? You were probably much younger and you know, this guy could maybe possibly freak you out, you know?
Yeah, but like, now Pittsburgh isn't New York, but I'm still a city boy and I have a good streetwise about me.
Sure.
And this isn't a good dude. And to just put a capper on it, I Googled the guy just out of curiosity within this year. And there were two cases. There is one where he invited. No, nothing happened. The kids, you see where this is going. The kids called the cops or whatever happened. But he like invited like boys into the limo, and they were like freaked out, and you know shit happened to him because of that. And then, I guess maybe even through that experience that got the cops like on his radar or something, they came into his house and he had something like, you know, one of those toxoplasmosis, like he's got 50 or 70 cats and some of them are dead and there's turds all over the place.
Oh, we come around to that again.
So,
oh,
you know, that's Harv's limo driver.
Yeah. That's his limo driver right there. Again, going back to the original, like I was like shocked too that Harvey had a limo driver and his name's Hollywood Bob. But
this limo driver was working in Slippery Rock,
No. It was like he drove Harv in a limo from Cleveland to Western PA. It was like 2.5 hours.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Okay. So he was based in Cleveland, Hollywood Bob.
Yeah, he can hang out.
But he wasn't around. Cleveland Bob.
No, no, man. What's yep. That's not a sexy name.
No.
Hollywood.
Well, I mean, I wanted to ask you know, a couple other questions to you, Ed, about your relationship with... So how did American Splendor impact or change your life? And I presume we're talking about the comic book here now, right? Because obviously the movie hadn't come out yet, and you'd seen him, you know, interviewed in the movies or on maybe, you know, snippets of the David Letterman show. But how did the comic book change your life?
It came under my radar at the perfect time because I was aging out of Spider-Man, other superhero titles, and I was desperately seeking comics that would be more of the Peter Parker parts. And that's American Splendor. It's 100% the Peter Parker parts, the real life stuff. A couple more things I have to say just about the clip that we checked out here.
Yeah.
This is, unfortunately, the legacy of Harvey in a lot of ways whenever his name is brought up in articles and retrospectives, when they call him cantankerous, when they call him curmudgeon. I think they're referencing this stuff from his television show appearances on Letterman. And I never had that vibe from him at all.
Me neither.
He had his opinions, and he would do his thing and kind of like march to his own drummer. But I never once had the vibe of him being the cantankerous, curmudgeon kind of guy that they always use those adjectives in every description of him, and it gets on my freaking nerves because it's just like they're parroting this Letterman stuff.
Well, it's the power of television. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't care how many comics you can make. And, you know, he basically covered his entire life in comic books, you know. The television, just the power of that. And the fact that he kind of went in swinging, you know, and he did put on a characteristic, you know, in a lot of ways.
Yeah. What you were just saying, Ed, it's funny because, you know, one of the things that brought the three of us together was SPX 2004. Five, I think, when we all were there together with Harvey. He was the guest of honor, and we were all on a panel together with him. And I remember at one point, Dean and I were hanging with Harvey because he was like given a free booth, you know, to sit and sell his stuff if he felt like it at times during the convention. And I think we were hanging out with him or like just gone to the little green room they had there to get like a drink or something. And he was complaining in a kind of mild way. He's like, why does everybody call me a curmudgeon? Yeah. You know? And I agree that all three of us never had that experience of him as a curmudgeon, but it was kind of funny and ironic that he was complaining in a very curmudgeonly way about being called a curmudgeon. But yeah, I mean, I agree with you guys 100%. Like, I feel like that was a bit of an act that he put on because it got a reaction from people, and it was definitely something he did for Letterman. And you know, you could read his comics and get a sense of that quality about him, but in real life, like just with people, he wasn't like that at all.
Yeah, but I mean, not for nothing, but his origin story, The Quitter, does, you know, from his own handwriting and, you know, storytelling, is a guy who's kind of a bully a little bit, you know, as a young kid. And then reading this, like, leading, you know, his American Splendor story, you know, about the first time going to David Letterman, he's preparing for a fight.
Yeah, he totally is.
It's kind of nuts. And it's all based on like some hearsay, or he's heard, or he doesn't like the way David Letterman treats guests, let's say. So he's going to get ready for that.
Right. And so he actually uses the terms like counterpunch
and like,
parrying,
I'm going to show him how we do it in the streets. I'm going to do it on TV. He'll never see it coming.
Yeah.
It's kind of, Ed, you got to reread this comic. It's a little, but the Harvey we all knew, like you said, working with the man and collaborating with the man, he had a heart of gold. He was a sweetheart.
At that same festival, SPX 2004 or 5, whenever that was, sitting next to him, this is right after the movie, probably, you know, within the same year, maybe a year later, I forget how that shakes out. So many people coming up to him, and frankly, a lot of attractive ladies. And when, like, this one particularly attractive lady split, I was like, Harv, man, all these pretty women coming up here and talking to you, man, like, this is crazy. He's like, you know what, man? My wife, she wouldn't even believe it, he said.
That's funny. But okay, so within going back to the unless you had some more thoughts about this scene, we're going to dive more into your world.
Do you guys want to hear a couple of facts?
Sure.
Related to the scene?
Sure.
How do facts interest you guys?
I love them.
Let's do it.
So the scenes that they showed of the appearances in David Letterman, FYI, the very first time he appeared was October 15th, 1986. And that actually does coincide with very close to when the Iran-Contra expose was first revealed. So it's interesting because it ties in, obviously, with the scene later on when Joyce leaves to go off and become more involved in the outside world and in politics and stuff. But of course, as you guys both know, Joyce was the co-writer of Brought to Light,
the
book about the Iran-Contra affair that was co-written with Alan Moore and illustrated by Bill Sienkiewicz and published by Eclipse Books in 1989. So that was kind of a cool little seeding of that, even though it has nothing whatsoever to do with this movie. But then what's interesting in the montage of Letterman appearances is they skip the second one and they go to the third one, which was March 24th, 1987. And then they skip the fourth one and they go on to the fifth one, which is the last one they show in the sequence, which was about a year after his first one on November 17th, 1987. So how's that for some factuals?
Wow. They left out some really good ones in the flick too. So I implore anybody to go on to YouTube. And there are compilations where you could watch basically all of them.
I recommend it.
And when this flick came out, it was well before the invention of YouTube. And this was my first opportunity to actually see these Letterman pieces that I read about so much. So let me tell you how much of a freaking nerd I am. I went home and no, I didn't grab like the new Busta Rhymes album off of Kazaa or whatever. They had clips. There were people out there like Dino who taped this stuff. And you know, obviously that's how it gets on YouTube. But before it got to YouTube, people were sharing this stuff on peer-to-peer networks.
Where
I never even thought to even search for Harvey Pekar, Letterman on Kazaa or Napster or something. But I did after that and was able to download all of the MPEGs myself.
Oh my God, it must have taken like 3 hours to download like one 5-minute clip.
You're being very, very generous because it was still dial-up. It was still 56K. You know, the very earliest days of high speed. And you just set it up and then forget about it for a week.
Oh my gosh.
And then it'll be there eventually.
Oh my God. That's
what's
amazing.
The rush?
That's amazing.
But one thing that I think, because we both reread the original Jerry Chamray American Splendor 12 piece beforehand, was that it was funny because in the comic, he sort of summarizes that first appearance in a very similar way to the way they do in the movie, you know, like the snippets that they show of it. But I actually felt like the movie kind of undercut Letterman a little bit as opposed to the way Harvey shows him in the comic. Because in the comic, you can tell that Letterman actually does ask him a couple of serious questions, like about what it's like to write for comics and how it works and, you know, asks him a little bit more about the comic itself. Whereas in the way that they framed it in the film, it really is just like this back and forth insult contest, and then you know Letterman gets a couple of good jabs in at the end.
Yeah, so, they played it more for comedy, I guess, in the movie. And
we're all storytellers here, man. If it was the David Letterman movie, you know, it'd be a little bit
right.
More,
it'd be different,
even-handed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Ed, I'm trying to get your chronology in order. Did you do WYSIWYG before you worked with Harvey in American Splendor?
Harvey is as important to me as my parents because he gave birth to my professional career. The first stuff I ever did professionally was with Harvey Pekar. I can't be more thankful. I think he took some pleasure in the fact that, like, I'm a Rust Belt from the sister city, Pittsburgh. There's the Pittsburgh-Cleveland rivalry all the time.
Totally.
He liked that I wasn't, you know, like you New Yorkers up there.
Those fancy types.
Yeah, totally. When the movie came out, whenever it came out.
2003.
Awesome. I dragged a friend there. Started sending Harvey comics after that. I got a call from him and about a week after seeing this movie, no joke.
Oh, wow.
Because you had sent him some of your stuff.
Exactly. His address was... Well, yeah. The P.O. box that was in those old American Splendor comics was still good. But the one that I used was a Dark Horse comic that has a photo cover. And it was like he was like a Time magazine, like Man of the Year. So it's a photo of Harv. And it's like it was a pre-sorted, like, you know, that laser printing whenever you have a magazine subscription. And it's like that dot matrix kind of lettering with your address.
Yes.
So it's that, but with Harvey's P.O. box. Like, that's what I used. And it worked. So it took a week after seeing the movie to get a call from him. I thought it was my friend who was doing a Harvey Pekor impersonation for real.
That's my story.
That sounds like a familiar story.
I did a one-pager about
it. I remember that.
I referenced Dino because I'm like, this is like the Haskell story. You just can't believe it. Especially the fact that, like, we just saw this movie. But the way that I operate with my friends, we're not frat boys. Like, we don't play jokes like that. And that would have been the meanest thing ever to do because I just quit my job. I was working at a call center and was like, I'm trying to grow up to become a cartoonist. Like, fuck having a boss who isn't as smart as me. You know, fuck being stuck in his hum-tum.
Otto and Repo Man.
So wait, Ed, was this... Because I have this memory that you called me, even though we didn't really know each other, or wrote me a letter or something asking me about, like, the experience of working for Harvey. Do you remember that?
Not specifically, but one of the things that Harv did was give me everybody's information. Like, all of his
that was
gallery. Like, he would do that. And just, I think probably the eager beaver in me is, like, just trying to get a little guidance from all you guys to just see what I'm in for and, like, what I should expect.
Yes.
There was some motivation there that I can't quite remember.
That's what it was, yeah.
But the most important thing personally to me was, like, my goal ever since I was a little kid was to become a professional cartoonist by age 21. And Harv helped me accomplish that because of, like, the Rust Belt situation here in Pittsburgh. Making money, like, you know, I grew up broke, no joke. And making money was an important part of this. Like, if I wasn't able to make a dollar at comics when I did, I would have just had to have gotten another job working. And I have no skills, you know? So the Harv, like, saved my life and gave me a career.
That's great.
So my first couple of comics with Harvey was like one pagers. Did you do like a one pager for him as like a little test kind of thing?
It was a four pager called Befuddled in American Splendor, our movie year. And then in the back of that, I guess he was contractually obligated. He had to fill the book up with about 24 or 28 more pages. I think it's 24. So I did that. He hit me up a week before my birthday, and he said something like, "Ed, do you want to do a lot of work in a very, very short amount of time?" Mm. And I'm fresh out of the Kubert School. I got out of there in 2000. Just, you know, I went there for 1 year. But one of the things they instill in you is, like, you take the job, you say yes, and then you figure it out later.
Then you figure it out. I always say whenever I say yes to a job, I'm lying.
Yeah.
Because I need to figure out how to do it now. But I'm looking at a note that Josh just handed me, and you did Befuddled, and then the second story in our movie year was Around the World and Back to Earth.
Yeah, that's it. Really, really rough. I had to submit pencils to him because you know, he just didn't know me and wanted to just make sure that I wasn't going to draw a cape or a cape and cowl on a domino mask or some shit. I don't know. But I had no time to do it. And I, you know, put my birthday celebrations on hold. I had my very first panic attack in my entire life working on that
strip. Congratulations.
Yeah, it was very memorable. And I got to draw Alan Moore, and that was cool for me. And I actually think Alan Moore put a curse on me when I drew him on that page, because I know of his magician shit. I was still living at home with Mom. I was drawing my comics. I had my little art table set up in the garage. And there's a famous Alan Moore Swamp Thing story called Halo of Flies. And I'm drawing Alan Moore, and I'm drawing all of that satanica that he has, all of those, like, weird symbols and his rings that might mean some crazy shit. And I still can't figure it out, but the garage got swarmed with flies, like while I was drawing those pages, and so much so that I actually had to like move out of there. We had to like bomb the garage area, and we never and there was carpeting and shit down there. We had to just roll the carpet up and get rid of it because there were like a disgusting amount of flies. We never found we never found any like, you know, rabbit that ran in there to like, you know, hide under something and die. Like there's no smell, there was nothing. It happened when I drew Alan Moore and put my Hunt 102 dip pen down and started drawing that beard that like the room got swarmed with flies, man.
Well, you probably like drew some, you know, like satanic symbols, you know, unknowingly that called forth a plague of flies.
That's what I'm saying, some Cthulhu type stuff. Yeah. That's why the first thing I thought was that Swamp Thing story, Halo of Flies. I'm like, oh, he cursed me.
It's like a Sam Raimi scene or something. So then from those couple of comics, you then go on to draw a graphic novel for Harvey Pico.
I think that 24-pager, that Around the World thing, I really do think that that was like a test in a way. Because as soon as I finished that, he said something like, he brought up the Macedonia thing. And there was an animated Peter Chung miniseries that came out right around then about like Alexander the Great and, you know, the King of Macedon and all that. And I'm like, ooh, is that what we're going to draw? We're going to draw like all of this cool shit about like a young dude who's taking over the world. Like I had no idea Harvey had this fascination. And it was like,
yes,
it was like about the geopolitical destabilization of the Balkan region,
the former Yugoslavia. Yes.
Talk about like the greatest cartooning boot camp ever, because I did it.
And it did a fine job of it.
Oh, that you're too kind, first off. But it was,
I have that book on my shelf.
It was such a slog, you know, like,
yeah, I can't imagine if Harvey had said to me, hey, Dean, after the quitter, what about, I'd be like, no, I can't do it. I don't know how to do that. That's one job I would say no to. Good
yeah,
Lord.
And of course, see that's that everything is relative kind of thing, because I'm just getting into the game and I'm going to do whatever I can.
Yep.
Because I'm just getting my footing, and I made, I made $15,000 on that. I know I had friends for many years after who cumulatively speaking didn't even make $15,000 on all their self-published or independent comics, you know? It was an illustration job. It was just 155 pages worth of illustration work. Yep. But, you know, that wasn't where I wanted my career to go. But he provided, I did Macedonia, then we did The Beats.
Actually, chronologically, you did one story in when we brought American Splendor, the series, over to Vertigo. You did a story called The Kirkus Reviewer.
Yeah, that's chronological in the print dates, but not in the production dates. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, right, because you worked on The Beats, and then it came out a lot later?
It did. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, like that was that weird, you know, there was, they'll talk about that period as being like a graphic novel boom, I fear, where the New York publishers were getting into the game, and everything had to be rooted in some kind of like nonfiction. I mean, it's still sort of like that with a lot of those New York publishers, you know, you got to make a comic about Tetris or some bullshit and you get your book deal or whatever. So Harv was like one of the early outliers of that.
Are you throwing shade on Vox Brown?
Is that who did that?
I think so.
Yeah, whatever.
Whatever. We're just discussing comics here, guys.
Yeah, totally.
It's all good.
It's all good.
It's just an example.
Yeah,
just talking
totally.
Examples here. So then The Beats came out, and you did all the work on that, correct?
There's like a couple main stories. I did 120 pages of work, and it might have been, say, 150-page book or something. So there's like some back matter drawn by a lot of other people that is actually really, really good stuff.
Mm-hmm. And then did you do something with the Studs Terkel work?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. Yeah, like 2 or 3 pages.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
And that would be, that's my Harvey output.
Yep.
So I remember back when I first started working with Harvey, he, you know, characterized me like, yeah, I like your stuff. You know, you do this or that well or whatever. So what was the input you got from Harvey about why he chose you as an artist? Like, was there something in particular about your style or your hatching or, you know, What did you learn from him that got you into his camp?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of ways to answer that. One of the things that I think was super attractive, frankly, is that neither of you guys would have accepted $100 a page to draw this shit, you know? So, like, it was young, eager beaver stuff. He was never more popular than at that moment right there after the film, you know, the Sundance, all of that shit happened. And he had so many deals, and he tried to make as many deals as he could. Mm-hmm. And I was just there. That cliche of, like, right place, right time. Mm-hmm. My stuff looked good enough to him, I guess, you know, to, like, get all this work. But he had all these opportunities and just said yes to them all. Like, Macedonia, like, he didn't even really write that in a lot of ways. The co-writer is Heather Roberson.
Heather Roberson, yeah.
And that, almost every word really comes from her. It's from her thesis.
Mm-hmm.
And I got that. And then she also, like, wrote a bunch of dialogue stuff that really, I'm being honest here, like, what Harv did was just take her exact kind of, you know, her monologue, essentially, and just broke it up in panels that I couldn't even use. Like, I had to, like, fit even more in. So, like, Harv was really kind of, like, just, like, a middleman on that project, you know?
Interesting.
It almost sounds like he was shepherding an idea that he wanted to be out there and had an opportunity to get a book out there with his name on it, almost like a kind of like a showrunner in print.
But
or
also
something.
I think it was a topic that he actually was, you know, had passion and you know, was interested in.
Absolutely. As I understand it, when he was doing tour stuff with the film, Heather's family, or she has some connection with some theater that where they showed the flick and did Q&As and stuff, and he got to meet her, he got to know her, and just heard about her experience. And he's such a literate, very well read guy. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys have ever visited his house, but
no.
he had a massive library of, like, legit library shelving in one of his upstairs bedrooms. And there would be barely enough space for your body to fit in between the stacks.
Whoa.
Like, say maybe there would be like four stacks and they would be front and back.
Uh-huh.
And it would be so hard to navigate through the, like, it would be so tight. You wouldn't be able to see all the stuff. But I mean, he had books on from metallurgy to, like, you know, whatever. Shakespeare.
Coal. Wow. I remember drawing a story where he was reading a book about coal.
I did not know about that library, though. That's interesting. That sort of belies the stereotype of the way his house looked and the, you know, lack of organization of his life in general. That's fascinating.
Well, let me tell you, I'll tell you that. Like, that was very organized. The entire upstairs hallway, he graduated from vinyl records to CD.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm taller, you know, I'm 6'2". Like, I'm definitely way taller than he was. And I don't think I could have, like, reached the top of the stacks. Like, so these things were, like, definitely piled up. But there is a lot of truth to the way he had the apartment and all that kind of thing portrayed. You know, there was downstairs in his main room, like, I just saw so many scripts. Like, every script he ever wrote, essentially, is just like, laying all over the place. And you just see these, like, typing paper, you know, reams just full of his little stick figures all over the place.
Yep.
All over the place. And he said that he still had boxes of everything. Like, he'd go down to the basement and peel off, like, some American Splendor 1s and 2s and 3s and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever get any of his original scripts? Did he mail them to you, or you just got
always
Xeroxes?
Xeroxes.
Yeah.
Did you get originals?
I believe I have mostly Xeroxes as well, but I feel like he might have accidentally mailed me an original or so.
Yeah.
I need to look.
I know
up.
I would get faxes of his stuff.
That too,
so
yeah.
He asked me about that, and I'm like, fax? Come on now. It's 2004, man. I don't know about that. And then I was thinking, like, am I going to have to go to Kogo's to, like, get this stuff from him?
Mm-hmm.
But you did, like... So you've been to his house, you would visit once in a while, or just through signings or something, or?
The one time, it was like, let me get some reference shots, because in 2003, 2004, this is still before Google image search is a viable option for reference. It was still very early in the development of that. So So I had no idea of what he looked like beyond what you guys drew him as. And everybody drew him a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the movie, but like, now I have to rely on the memory of that. Like, the DVD isn't out yet even. So I had to go out there and just like snap, get a couple of snaps.
Right.
And it was, you know, it was like true to form. It was a character. Like, when I got to the house, we had to pick him up. Like, we went to his house first thing and picked him up and took him to like the auto body shop. And he needed to pick his car up from the shop. And there was like, it was a $600 bill for whatever they did to his car.
Right.
And he just deflated, his face in his hands, like, ah.
And he's just meeting you physically for the first time?
Yeah, that's our first meeting. It's not our first conversation. Like, we talk a lot.
No, of course, of course.
But that, yeah, the first time I laid eyes on him, he's like, oh yeah, could you take me over to the thing?
So, like, when was the last time you spoke to him or saw him, you know, before he passed away?
It would have been post-Beats. And what would have probably have happened is I would get calls very, very regularly.
Right.
To, like, read reviews. So, like, basically, he didn't feel like going to the library to, like, ask them to, like, type in Harvey Pekar, the Beats, and, like, see what articles are being written or whatever.
You know, I kind of remember him calling me and asking me
about
to read a review or something.
He would do that with you, Dean?
I totally forgot about it until you mentioned
That's
it. I remember
crazy.
Thinking that was odd. And maybe because he didn't... like
He just didn't know how to use a computer.
Oh,
even man. Though they had one at the house.
That's... Yeah, no, like, yeah, he never cared to touch it. You know, like a lot of older people, man, they think that they'll break it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't know what they're doing. So very often, like, we would connect and then I would go online and read whatever reviews I could find and, you know, we would just talk shop that way.
What were you working on after working with Harvey? Did you show him any of that other new stuff? Did you relate to that? Did he relate to you in any other way professionally, or were you just guys pals at that point?
Yeah, I mean, we were totally cool, but I never wanted to bother the guy with, you know, my comics. You know, he got my comics in the mail initially. That's how we hooked up. That's how we connected. But when I went to his house and I saw the library and I saw the albums and I saw like some of the other stuff they have, I never saw comics. So it's like, I don't want to just clutter them up with these comics.
Sure.
or any of that stuff, man.
Sure. Well, we're going to wrap up soon, I think.
Okay.
But any other final thoughts? And then, I mean, obviously this, it's a little off topic, but, you know, if you could talk a little bit briefly about Hip Hop Family Tree and X-Men Grand Design and Cartoonist Kayfabe. I mean, you have so much other stuff you've done since working with Harvey, you know?
And
yeah,
also,
sure.
If there's anything else that either of you guys have about the scene in particular, like any of the Toby stuff, or if there's anything more, or do we feel like we kind of cover that? I have a couple of other like little behind the scene things that I could just throw in there before. But
I have one or two things. Like, Toby, not only was he the MTV nerd or whatever, but Troma made a movie that included him.
Yes.
I forget what it's called.
Killer Nerd, I think.
That is what it's called, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I do remember that, and I never associated it with Harvey or American Splendor or any of that, because I didn't read those comics at that point. And then after the movie, quite a ways after, Toby made appearances on the Howard Stern Show.
Yeah, I think I read that he was actually up for like a recurring role or something and was like down to one of the finalists, but then didn't end up getting it.
Yeah,
like as
yeah,
one of the studio guys.
The one of the guys who beat him, like deservedly so. And this is a dubious honor because it was to become a member of the Whack Pack, but but he was really good on there, and even maybe a little borderline gross, because they asked him for different synonyms for ejaculate, and so like in his Toby voice he's saying like spooge and like shit like that.
All right, we just got an explicit rating on this show.
So maybe, yeah, maybe Harv was right at the end of the scene about being exploited and co-opted by corporations.
You think so?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, and did you have some little other notes, Josh, about the scene?
Yeah, I mean, it seems so trivial now, but hey, That's what I live for. So, yeah, just a more behind-the-scenes stuff from the director's commentary. The real Joyce was saying that when they were on David Letterman, they were often booked with Jungle Jack Hanna, if you guys remember him, the director of the Columbus Zoo. And I just find that really funny. And I guess they were, you know, playing off of that because they had that actor, Terrence Sullivan, who plays like a sort of Crocodile Dundee version of Jack Hanna on this episode. But yeah, it's just kind of funny that they were like, yeah, well, we're always going to pair Harvey Pekar, the comic writer from Cleveland, with the guy who brings animals, you know, from the Columbus Zoo.
Funny animals.
Yeah. And the directors were saying that when they were casting the film, they actually considered trying to get Tony Randall to play that role. And also John Waters.
Right.
But and the actual Jack Hanna. And none of those people were available. I think Tony Randall died actually pretty soon after the movie came out. So that's how they ended up with Terrence Sullivan, who I think that was the only role that he ever had. And maybe he was just a guy who could hold a...
I think it was a crocodile or an alligator. Was like it a like baby a baby alligator, alligator? Or something like that, yeah.
And then also Joyce happened to meet and mentioned that they met Heather Locklear and Jerry Seinfeld backstage. So they were also on with those two eminent stars.
Oh, cool. Well, because we're wrapping it up, I just want Ed quickly to talk about Hip Hop Family Tree, X-Men Grand Design, Cartoonist Kayfabe, and then I have a final question for Ed. So please, Ed, tell us.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, so Hip Hop Family Tree is probably the one I'm known for the most. That's the one, that's the comic that probably displays the most stuff that I learned from Harvey. Mm. The idea of choosing the exact proper moments when you're talking about a vast array of material. It's stuff I picked up from him, from the Beats and from Macedonia, where there would have to be like some heavy captioning up top. You choose a moment and then maybe the next panel, it's not a second to second transition. It's like a year to year transition and sometimes in. So that proved successful.
I love that. I love that stuff, by the way.
Thanks, Josh.
Congratulations on all that.
That was great.
I love the tone that you strike with it because it has that whimsical quality that's just, you know, part of what your voice as a cartoonist is, but then it's serious historical record of a period that isn't documented to a lot of people. I mean, I know there's a lot of, you know, historical stuff on that, but not for most audiences. And I think you really like strike that balance. Yeah, and it's just awesome.
I see the Hip Hop Family Tree. It's kind of like the dictionary of rap and hip hop and the history of that. It's just got everything you ever wanted, you know, in it.
Yeah, I want it to be comprehensive.
And that was the period of my musical upbringing too. So I totally love it.
Yep. You couldn't escape a lot of those tunes when you went to a birthday pizza party at the roller skate rink.
Or the bodega.
But then X-Men Grand Design, yeah, that happens after that. When I finished the fourth volume of Hip Hop, you know, that was a 4.5 year bid. I wanted to take a little break from that, and I just put a tweet out into the universe that Marvel should let me make whatever X-Men comic I feel like making, and they actually bit and got in touch. And then it was all a bluff that they called. So when I had to show and prove, they asked me what I wanted to do. I said, I want to do it all. And to me, all of the X-Men means up until Chris Claremont leaves, because I don't know that they ever made an X-Men comic after his tenure.
Yeah, yeah, I don't think they ever did.
I think you nailed it there.
So I just finished that, man.
Don't bury the lead. Like, it's amazing that you tweeted out this idea and then Marvel gave you the reins.
That's great.
Incredible. That's, but that was because of all the hard
every
work you put in.
Dream.
In your oeuvre thus far, which was this comprehensive Hip Hop Family Tree. So in a way, you kind of extended
and Macedonia.
Extended the Hip Hop Family Tree into the X-Men Grand Design.
It's the same kind of style. Like I'm interested in world building and trying that out. So like the hip hop thing is on rails because I have real world history that I have to pull from. The X-Men thing, you could be a little bit more liberal, have a little bit more fun with. You don't have to worry about Wolverine calling you up 2 a.m. threatening to sue you,
or worse, snicked.
Or hear the word snicked and then look at the three long blades coming out of your chest.
The wet t-shirt contest, as they call it in hip-hop parlance.
Oh man. Wait, so did you wrap that up? You're still working on X-Men, right? Grand Design?
No, like the very last issue just came out, like the 26th of June.
Congratulations.
Awesome.
It was like over 1,000 days in a row of work, man, 7 days a week, so...
Wow.
So what's next, sir?
I am working on some. I finished the first draft of my next thing. The other comic publishers, you know, the Image, the Dark Horse, like those kind of people who are interested in independent work are interested in doing some work with me. I finished the first draft. I'm taking a screenwriting course right now.
Oh, cool.
With a very experienced writer, and just getting my stuff torn to pieces and then reshaping it, and it'll get torn to pieces again. So the hope is I'm no longer on rails with my world building exercise. I'm creating my own world. And this time it's without a tether, completely my own thing, my own ideas. And we'll see what happens with that, man. It's going to take a while, though.
Can't wait to see that.
I believe when we were at the Brooklyn Book Festival last fall, 2018, and I hosted a moderated a panel that you were on, I think that was one of my questions, is like, you're always excavating other worlds like hip hop or X-Men. And I wanted to know if you were going to create your own. And it sounds like that is what you're doing.
For sure. I have other nonfiction ideas for the future, but you know, if everything works the way I hope, I should have a couple more, a decade or two left in me.
That's great. And I still want to add, I've done two pinups for your hip hop family tree. I did Mantronics, Just Ice and Mantronics, and I want to do one or two more. So get back on that at some point. All right.
Yeah, man. It would be nice to take it to volume 6 for sure, but it's my life's work. Like, I'll get back to it. It's there. It's waiting for
me. Well, I'm calling now. I'm doing MC Search because he's one of my buddies. Me and Josh knew him from high school.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And Egyptian Lover. All right, so hold those out for me.
That's great.
And then my final question to you is, what do you miss most about Harvey Pekar and American Splendor?
He would call up and I moved out of the house basically whenever I was working with him. But at the earliest part of our relationship, if you want to call it that, he would just call up to BS. But then he would want to talk to my pops, and they would go back and forth calling each other all kinds of names when it came to Steelers versus Cleveland Browns football.
Oh my God.
And so it was
that's hilarious.
You know, my own dad is obviously extremely important to me, and Harv gave birth to my professional career. So just kind of like being around that vibe was like real special and real important. And it's like, that's the segue point, man. It's like little Ed is like leaving the nest and it's Harv who helped make that possible in like a major way. And you know, I think my pops even like let Harv know that in a way where it was like, yo, man, this kid's 21. He's got to get the hell out of this crib. Thank you for, you know, putting a couple dollars in his pocket so he could pay, you know, first and last month's rent.
And doing what he loves, making comics. And what you're saying is if Harvey became part of your family.
Well said. A super cool uncle.
Yep. That's great.
Oh, wait. Did you want to talk about Cartoonist Kayfabe real quick?
Oh, yeah. Final plug.
Yeah, it's just a YouTube channel that Jim Rugg and I have put together where we cut our teeth, our puppy teeth, during the speculation boom of the 1990s. So we're using Wizard Magazine as our backbone to talk about that crazy period of time in comics whenever the robber barons came in and thought of many different ways to divest young children of their hard-earned allowances.
So true, so true. And for those who are not familiar with the kayfabe term, can you just...
It's a wrestling term.
Yeah. Wrestling terminology, we use it differently in a weird way. Like, to a wrestler, it's protecting the business, like trying to convince everybody that it's real. But the way that we use it is breaking kayfabe, which is, let's give you a little inside scoop. Frankly, what we just did right here, where we talk about Hollywood Bob for 15 minutes or, you know, some of that other stuff. It's just like, let's be real. No customer chatter here.
Yep. That's great.
That's awesome.
Well, Ed, thanks so much for talking to us about this scene and talking about your relationship with Harvey and the work you did. Great talking to you, man.
Same here.
Thanks for choosing me for this scene, guys.
Absolutely.
Well, that about wraps up this episode. Thanks, Ed, so much for coming on with us. Remember that you can visit us at scenebyscenepodcast.com and Scene by Scene on Facebook, where you can subscribe, download past episodes, read up on the show, check out our work, including all things Harvey Pekar, and join the discussion. And you know, I don't know if we have ever publicly given a shout out to the man who's provided the music for our show.
We have not.
My brother-in-law, Evan Wilson.
Great music.
EvanWilsonMusic.com. Thank you, Ev. And until next time, this is Josh Neufeld.
This is Dean Haspiel.
I'm Ed Piskor.
With Scene by Scene with Josh and Dean. All right, we're done.